everyone, and welcome to the second part of our vampire episode, and welcome to What's in Your Hometown, where we talk about the dirty little secrets in your backyard. I'm trying to stop cussing as much.
All right. Good luck with that.
This you know me as a human being.
This might not be the episode to not cuss.
It is not. Reminder, before we start getting into what's in our backyard, this is going to be a particularly dark episode, so content warning. If you're not comfortable with darker content, I would just skip this one and meet us up next episode.
Yeah, if we're already a little bit too much for you,
this is going to
be worse than we normally are. So, See you later. Thanks.
We understand.
Go check out Conspiracies and Cryptids, because they're really fun to listen to.
It's a little dark. But Barely. Before we get into that, Julia, what's in your backyard?
The earth is dying. And
it is.
Okay, so as of this recording, it is January 12th. I am still in West Virginia, which means that it's winter. Mm-hmm. And it was 78 degrees yesterday.
For those of you who don't understand, West Virginia winters start approximately October and last until May. Mm-hmm. But the snow starts in January.
Yeah.
So it should not be 70 degrees.
It should not be almost 80 degrees in January.
Yeah, no.
But no, that's what's in my backyard. I went out in a dress yesterday and it was just so nice. It was beautiful outside. It was like balmy and everyone was happy and there were people out and I went for a walk and I just couldn't escape the feeling that this is so very wrong.
It is. It's very wrong. Do you remember when we were little? Because I remember when we were little, we haven't had a winter like it in a while, where like you could hear the trees crack because of the ice on them.
Yeah.
And we haven't had that in a really long time.
No.
And that was like every winter when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm. No, it used to get really, really bad when we were kids, but it's fine. We've had icy roads like twice.
We're killing the earth. I'm sorry, earth. On behalf of humanity, I apologize.
Yep. I'm going to try to do better. I bought reusable K-cups. And
I bought reusable plastic baggies.
Yeah, it's nice. And I'm trying so, so hard to not use single-use almost anything.
The only reason my lazy ass has not bought plastic silverware is because I'm like, I need to save the earth, so I'll do my dishes, I guess.
Right?
I'm trying.
It's fine. But no, that was my New Year's resolution. I'm doing pretty well on it. What's in your backyard this week?
My backyard is part of my New Year's resolution was getting on a schedule, and part of that schedule was I was a creative writing major. I haven't written since I graduated undergrad. So for like the past almost 4 years now, I haven't written a single word. So I started going to Las Vegas, since it's a city, has this really nice, like I never used Meetup in West Virginia because what's the point? But Las Vegas has all these meetup classes. And so I've started going to like creative writing classes. Mm-hmm. Love it. So that's basically what's been in my backyard is I've gotten back into a comfortable place to start writing again.
Oh, good. That's fantastic.
Oh, it makes me feel very happy and fulfilled.
Yay.
Maybe in 25 years, I'll publish something.
You'll get to it. It's fine.
I'll get to it eventually. But I mean, that's basically all. I went back to work. But that's about it. My backyard is very uneventful so far. Oh, before we get started, Julia, tell the people about the podcast or the network.
Well, this is What's in Your Hometown. It's a podcast.
I keep saying podcast because I just feel like it's like a family thing.
But it is like a family thing.
The network is the family thing.
Yeah. Okay. So we are part of the Civilized Creatures Entertainment Network. We really love who we work with. we have other shows on the network like Married AF and Picks and Bones and Drinks with Larry and the Cinemundo podcast. Just, they're absolutely fantastic human beings. And really, there is something for everyone on this network. So, you know, go ahead, give them a peek, if you will. And
if you listen to us, we promise there will be another show on this network that you love.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's great people doing great things. And mm-hmm. they're so much fun to listen to, and they're so much fun to work with. Podcast of the Roundtable is going to start back up pretty soon, so that'll be great.
I've started catching back up on Drinks with Larry, like, when I go to work in the mornings, just because I'm grumpy in the mornings, and they're funny, so so by the time I get to work, I'm like, okay, I'm in a good mood now.
Yeah, exactly. That's just what they do. They're fantastic. So, yeah, go ahead, check them out. Make sure that you are listening to the wonderful people who help to support us, and we help to support them, and they're wonderful, and we love them, so.
Yep, yep.
Yep.
All right, so welcome back to the second half of our vampires episode. Like I said, it's going to be a darker episode, just a little heads up. This man murdered about 56 people. Most of them were children. So it's a darker episode. I do not recommend you look this man up on the internet in any capacity.
Don't do it. Also, if our Vampire of Sacramento episode was a little too dark for you, this is the time to dip out.
Yep. Vampire of Sacramento was the least awful vampire that
seriously
I have found so far.
Yeah.
So let's jump straight into it, because we do have an extra long episode again for you guys.
But yes, I'm so here for this. This is fun.
All right, so we covered the origins of the vampire legend, but the monster is still a threat within today's society. While the silver screen reminds us every few years of the popular monster with movies like Interview with a Vampire, Nosferatu, Blade, Quentin Tarantino's Bizarre, From Dusk Till Dawn, Twilight, and many more, real-life vampires aren't quite as nice as they are portrayed. Over the years, the word vampire has taken on a more nefarious meaning. Present-day vampires have diverged into two different types: those that adopt a relatively harmless vampire lifestyle, and those who slaughter under the mad spell of bloodlust. And that's what present-day vampires are. So past vampires were just walking corpses that knocked on doors and you died of the plague a couple days later. Present-day vampires actively murder you.
All right. Smidge different.
Smidge different. The modern day vampires are most often the worst of the worst when it comes to serial killers, and that's saying a lot.
Seriously. Y'all got some stiff competition there.
Mm-hmm. Men like Fritz Haarman, also known as the Vampire of Hanover or the Butcher of Hanover, who is believed to be responsible for at least 27 murders, most of which he killed by biting through their throats.
Oh, nope.
Tsutomu Miyazaki, or the little girl killer who murdered four children and drank the blood of one of his victims. Marcelo de Andrade, I hope, who murdered 14 boys and drank their blood in order to become as beautiful as them. Elizabeth of Bathory, which we've covered before, and California's own Richard Chase, which we've also covered before. And the topic of today's episode, Andre Chikatilo.
Okay.
So Andrei Chikatilo is a Soviet serial killer nicknamed the Butcher of Rostov, or the Red Ripper, and the Rostov Ripper. So this was during Soviet Russia.
Okay.
Or during the Soviet Union era. Between 1978 and 1990, he sexually assaulted, murdered, and mutilated at least 43 women and children in the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, Ukraine, Soviet Socialist Republic, and the Uzbek, or how do you say it?
Uzbekistan?
Uzbek, because it's Uzbekistan. The Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic. And I say those because I'm going to be using the abbreviations for them, the USSR and stuff like that.
Okay.
So there's where all that started. So we murdered 43 of them. that he was convicted of. He confessed to 56 murders and was originally tried for 53 of them, but the Supreme Court of Russia ruled in 1993 that insufficient evidence existed to prove Chikatilo's guilt in 9 of the murders, so his overall body count, or his overall proven body count, is 43.
That is so many cases to prosecute. That is so many people.
There was literally, like, just reading the indictments took a whole day of court.
Seriously. It's 43. Holy shit, man. I just watched the Atlanta child killings, a documentary mm-hmm. about the Atlanta child killings, and they only got him on 2 people. Because that was, like, holy shit.
No, they had quite a long time to gather evidence for their case because they weren't very good at doing their jobs.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Wait until we get to do it. Because as I was reading this, my face was like, what the fuck is happening? I know that your face is going to be like, Jesus Christ, will they just arrest this man?
Oh, God. This is not a good... All right, I'm here for it.
Okay. So Andrei Chikatilo was born in October of 1936 in a village of Yublekny or Yublechnik in the Sumy Oblast. And Oblast is just like province of the Ukraine SSR. So it's basically the northeastern part of Ukraine.
Okay.
At the time of his birth, Ukraine was in the grips of a bad famine caused by Joseph Stalin's forced collectivization of agriculture. So basically, it was think of yeah. it like you give yeah, everything
Stalin,
to your
Stalin's
king.
Stalin's a bad dude.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a real bad time. Seriously.
It was not a good time. See, Chikatilo's parents were both collective farmer laborers who lived in a one-room hut, received no wages for their work, and instead received the right to cultivate a plot of land behind the family hut. So they were farmers that didn't receive anything for doing their jobs except for the right to have a garden behind their hut.
Mm-hmm.
So suffice it to say, they were incredibly poor. They seldom had sufficient food. Chikatilo himself later claimed that he didn't eat bread until the age of 12. He also said that his family often had to eat grass and leaves to stave off hunger. Throughout his childhood, his mother repeatedly told him that prior to his birth, his older brother, Stepan, had been kidnapped and cannibalized by starving neighbors. So it was a poor community. That also sounds like it sounds like a Little Red Riding Hood type of story. Like, don't go into the woods after dark; you'll be eaten by a wolf.
That sounds so fucking horrific. If it's real, though,
I know. Well, it's never been established that this brother ever existed. So it sounds like something that his mother just told him. And we'll see later on that his mother wasn't the most warm and lovely, like cuddly type of person. So it sounds like something his mother just told him to make him behave or okay. to stop crying.
That's fair.
Yes. So when the Soviet Union entered the Second World War, Chikatilo's father, Roman, was conscripted to the Red Army. So between 1941 and 1944, Chikatilo witnessed some of the effects of the Nazi occupation of Ukraine, which even he described as horrific.
Ooh.
Yeah, he did not have a great childhood. He witnessed bombings, fires, and shootings from which he and his mother would hide in cellars and ditches. At one point, he and his mother were forced to watch their own hut burn to the ground. And that was the only shelter they had.
I can see how that would cause some issues later in life. Not these issues, but some issues.
Some issues. Yeah, you need some therapy for that.
Mm-hmm.
With his father at war, Chikatilo and his mother shared a single bed, and he was a chronic bedwetter. So that trifecta of murderers, bedwetting, setting fires, and killing animals, he pretty much hit all of it.
Yeah.
He was a chronic bedwetter, and his mother berated and beat him for each offense.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Not good.
In 1943, his mother gave birth to his sister Tatiana. His father was still not even near her at this point. Like, his father was still in the army. He was actually a prisoner of war that was definitely not his father's child.
Oh, not great. Okay.
And then in September of 1944, Chikatilo began school. And as you can imagine, it was not a great time for him. Although shy and ardently studious, he was physically weak and regularly attended school in homespun clothing. And he often fainted as a result of the post-war famine, which plagued much of the Soviet Union. So he was constantly targeted by bullies who regularly mocked him over his physical stature and timid nature.
Mm-hmm.
At home, he and his sister were constantly berated by their mother. His sister later recalled that their father was a kind man, but their mother was harsh and unforgiving. Mm. Altogether, he had an absolutely horrid childhood. To make things worse, at the onset of puberty, Chikatilo discovered that he suffered from chronic impotence, worsened by his social awkwardness and self-hatred.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. As a result, Chikatilo developed a passion for reading and memorizing data and often studied at home, both to increase his sense of self-worth and to compensate for his myopia. Nearsightedness, yeah, myopia.
Okay.
So he just couldn't see the classroom blackboard.
Okay.
Following his graduation, because he did do good in school, he did good enough. He was the only student from his quote-unquote collective farm, so like from that plot that his village shared, to complete the final year of school. But following his graduation, Chikatilo applied for a scholarship to Moscow State University. And although he passed the entrance examination with good scores, his grades were not deemed good enough for acceptance, although he thought he was denied enrollment because his father had been branded a traitor for, and get this, being taken prisoner after being wounded in combat.
Oh, fuck.
Right? So he gave up on university and instead in 1955 traveled to the city of Kursk, where he worked as a laborer for 3 months before enrolling in a vocational school with the aim of becoming a communications technician.
Okay.
I should give a warning now, two warnings. It's about this point where everything starts getting really, really bad and continues getting worse. Also, all of these names are Russian. Oh. And I have looked up the pronunciation. I looked up so many pronunciations of different names. And there were like a couple where like I heard the name and I just laughed out loud. I was like, I'm not going to be able to say that like ever.
You messaged me a couple times and I'm like, oh, this won't end well. Okay, cool.
So I'm trying my best to speak Russian.
It is. Oh, hello.
Hello, kitty. So please don't be mad at me for these names. So the same year, Chikatilo formed his first serious relationship with a local girl 2 years his junior. However, despite this relationship, he still suffered from impotence, and after 18 months, she broke off the relationship. In 1957, he completed his vocational training and relocated to Urals City in Nizhnya Tagil to work on a long-term construction project where he worked for 2 years before being drafted into the Soviet Army. Between 1957 and 1960, he completed his compulsory military service with an unblemished record and joined the Communist Party. After completing his service, he returned to his native village to live with his parents, where he soon became acquainted with a young divorcee. Like his previous relationships, this one ended 3 months later due to his impotence, but not before his girlfriend asked her friends for advice as to how Chikatilo might overcome his inability to maintain an erection, which, small towns being small towns, resulted in most of his peers discovering his impotence.
Yeah, that's bad. That's bad for you.
Yeah. In 1933, he gave an interview where he spoke of the incident, stating that, quote, girls were going behind my back, whispering that I was impotent. I was so ashamed, I tried to hang myself. My mother and some young neighbors pulled me out of the noose. Well, I thought that no one would want such a shamed man, so I had to run away from there, away from my homeland.
Oh, God, that's bad.
Mm-hmm. And he did. He just sort of ran away. After several months, Chikatilo found a job as a communications engineer in a town located north of Rostov on Don. Hopefully, he relocated to the Russian SFSR in 1961, renting a small apartment close to his workplace. The same year, his younger sister Tatiana finished her schooling and moved into his apartment.
Okay.
So Tatiana lived with her brother for 6 months before marrying a local youth and moving into her in-laws' home. She noted nothing untoward regarding her brother's lifestyle beyond his chronic shyness around women, and resolved to help her brother find a wife and start a family. And in 1963, Chikatilo married a woman named Theodosia.
I love Theodosia Anakiva.
Barely 2 weeks after they had met. So it was basically an arranged marriage set up by his sister and her husband.
Okay.
Suffice it to say, the sex life was mostly non-existent.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you this. I might cut this later. This is because they had children. This is how they had children, Julia.
Okay.
This is some fucked up shit. His wife understood he was unable to maintain an erection, so they agreed she would conceive by him ejaculating externally and pushing his semen inside her vagina with his fingers.
Okay. Sure. All right. Yep.
Sorry, I don't know why that's so funny. I think it's just weird enough that I don't know what else to do but laugh.
Maybe. That sounds like a less complicated turkey baster method, honestly. Like, you just, with less equipment. Baster. It's just...
Yeah. It's the poor man's turkey baster.
We're good.
And despite this, in 1965, Theodosia gave birth to their daughter, Lyudmila. And 4 years later, she had a son named Yuri. Yuri, I know I said right. Lyudmila, I have no idea.
Right, yeah.
In 1964, before the birth of their son, Chikatilo chose to enroll as a correspondence student at Rostov University, studying Russian literature and philology. He obtained his degree in 1970 and in 1971 began his career as a teacher of Russian languages and literature in Novoshakhtinsk. Novoshakhtinsk, I believe.
Okay.
He was largely ineffective as a teacher, unable to maintain discipline in his class. He was regularly subjected to mockery by his students. He should have never been allowed near children. Ever.
Oh, no.
So he got that job in 1971. In May of 1973, he committed his first known sexual assault on one of his students. He was never disciplined for any of these incidents.
Oh.
But in response to an increasing number of complaints lodged against him by his students, the director of the school summoned Chikatilo to a formal meeting to inform him he could either resign or be fired.
Okay. How many did that take? Because seriously, it should take one. This should take one?
Yeah. Don't look this man up. It took a lot.
Okay.
No, there was absolutely nothing done about him. And it infuriates me every single time I go through these notes. So he chose to leave. There were no charges brought against him. Nothing. He chose to leave and found another job as a teacher in another school in the same area.
This is infuriating.
I know.
What?
I know. Okay. So in 1978, he lost his job as a result of staff cutbacks, but found another teaching position in Shakhty, a coal mining town close to Rostov. Why do they keep giving him these jobs? March of 1981, his career as a teacher ended due to continued accusations of sexual assault.
Okay, cool. Great. That took about 8 years longer than it should have.
Way longer than it should have. Finally, in 1981, his teaching career ended way later than it should have.
And, like, I understand. It was a totally different time, and it was a whole different era, and it was a different country, and you treat these things differently. I'm pretty sure child molestation has been one of those universally bad things.
Exactly. Now, spoiler alert, just to make people feel a little better, he was brought up on charges for all of this after he killed 56 people. So he did get his comeuppance.
Okay.
Way too late. The same month that he finally ended his teaching career, or his teaching career was ended for him, he began a job as a supply clerk for a factory based in Rostov, which required Chikatilo to travel extensively across much of the Soviet Union. And this became a huge problem for investigators looking into all of the murders that he committed, because it was never in one place.
Okay.
In December of 1978, he committed his first murder. The victim was a 9-year-old girl named Yelena Zakatnova. After stabbing her, he threw her body into the nearby Grushvka River. Her body was found 2 days later. Get ready to be mad.
I'm already mad.
Numerous pieces of evidence linked him to Yelena's murders. I can't pronounce anything now because it's all Russian. Numerous pieces of evidence linked him to Yelena's murders. Spots of blood had been found in the snow near a house that Chikatilo had purchased. Neighbors had noted that Chikatilo had been present in the house on the evening of the 22nd. Yelena's school rucksack had been found upon the opposite bank of the river at the end of the street, indicating that she had been thrown in the river at this location. And witnesses had given police a detailed description of a man closely resembling Chikatilo, whom the witnesses had seen talking to Yelena at the bus stop where she had been last seen alive. Despite all of this, a 25-year-old laborer named Alexander Kravchenko was arrested.
Okay.
Yeah, despite all that evidence, they just went, nope, and looked at this man. But don't feel too bad for Alexander. He had previously served a prison sentence for the rape and murder of a teenage girl.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Still,
that's an awful lot of evidence to just go, nah.
That seems like a bad... seems like the first in a series of many bad decisions by people who are paid not to make bad decisions.
It is the first in a series of many bad decisions from people who are paid to not make bad decisions. See, in the search for Kravchenko's home, so they focused in on this one man, and then they got, a warrant. I'm not quite sure how Russian law works, but they searched his home. The search revealed spots of blood on his wife's jumper. The blood type was later determined to match both Yelena and Kravchenko's wife. So a little bit of information before going forward. During this time, you couldn't do a DNA match. You could just do a match to the type of blood. So either AB positive, AB negative, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it was the 70s.
Yeah, it wasn't like an exact science. So what they found was this blood type that matched Yelena. The blood type also matched Kravchenko's wife.
That wouldn't hold up in any court that I can think of. It's like, no, I just bled on my own sweater. What are you doing here? Why do you have my sweater?
Holds up in the Soviet Union.
Yep.
Kravchenko also had an airtight alibi for the afternoon Yelena went missing. He had been at home with his wife and a friend of hers for the entire afternoon. So he had two people vouching for where he was. However, under threat from the police, the women soon gave new statements claiming that Kravchenko had not returned home until later in the evening on the day of the murder.
Not great.
Confronted with these testimonies, Kravchenko confessed to the killing, because what else was he going to do? It was the whole justice system pitted against him.
Yeah.
He was tried for the murder in 1979. At his trial, Kravchenko retracted his confession and maintained his innocence, stating his confession had been obtained under extreme duress, which I do not doubt. Despite his retraction, Kravchenko was convicted of the murder and sentenced to death. This sentence was commuted to 15 years imprisonment, which was the maximum possible length of imprisonment at the time by the Supreme Court in December of 1980. But under pressure from the victim's relatives, Kravchenko was retried and eventually executed by firing squad for Yelena's murder in 1983.
Okay, not great. Not great.
Not great.
Not great.
Not a great start to this investigation.
No.
9 months later... 9 months later, Chikatilo stabbed 13-year-old Lyubov Burek to death. Her body was found on the 27th of June. The medical examiner discovered evidence of 22 stab wounds.
Jesus.
That's the least amount of stab wounds that were found on his bodies.
I would imagine so, because, you know, you don't tend to calm down when you murder more people.
Exactly.
That's where you're starting? Holy shit.
That's where he started.
Okay. Bad.
In addition, this is also where he started, Julia. In addition, several striations were discovered upon Burek's eye socket. He was cutting the eyes out of his victims.
Oh, I don't like that. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. That's a weird thing for me.
I don't know. Between July and September of 1982, he killed another 5 people. Just between July and September.
Just so many people to mm-hmm. not get caught for another 8 years.
Yeah. Most of the victims' bodies bore evidence of mutilation to the eye sockets, and pathologists concluded that these injuries had been caused by a knife, leading investigators to the conclusion the killer had gouged out the eyes of his victims.
So bad.
Chikatilo's adult female victims were often prostitutes or homeless women whom he would lure into secluded areas with promise of alcohol or money, and then he would kill them. It would be a particularly vicious murder if they mocked his impotence.
Mm-hmm.
On December 11th, 1982, he murdered 10-year-old Olga Stamokchinok. Again, I'm so sorry about butchering these names. Stabbing her in excess of 50 times around the head and body.
Fuck. Okay. Mm-hmm.
By January 1983, the police had linked 4 victims to the same killer, leading them to believe they had a serial killer on their hands. So it wasn't until 1983 that they even discovered that these murders were by the same man.
Okay, that's not good that it's taken from 1978 to 1983. That by itself, not fantastic. However,
not fantastic.
This doesn't end until, you said 1990?
Yeah.
Not less fantastic. Not good. You have a serial killer around for 7 years, and you don't figure that out? Whew, all right.
So a Moscow police team headed by Major Mikhail Fetisov was sent to Rostov-on-Don to direct the investigation, which gradually became known amongst investigators as Operation Forest Path. Fetisov established a team of 10 investigators based in Rostov, charged with solving all 4 cases, because mm-hmm. they only had 4 cases at that point.
Mm-hmm.
In March, Fetisov assigned a newly appointed specialist forensic analyst, Viktor Burakov, to head the investigation. The following month, Olga's body was found. So this was before they even found Olga's body.
Okay.
They had 4. He continued murdering. There were those 4 more. And then they found Olga's body.
Not good.
Burakov was summoned to the crime scene where he examined the numerous knife wounds and striations upon her eye sockets. He later stated that as he noted the striations upon her eye sockets, any doubts about the presence of a serial killer evaporated. So it was about this time that they were like, it's definitely a serial killer.
Okay.
Too late.
Okay. Well, they figured it out at all, and I guess we should give credit where credit's due.
They did figure it out. Chikatilo didn't kill again until June of 1983, when he murdered 15-year-old Laura Sarkisian. By September, he had killed a further 5 victims. So the body count's just adding up.
Yeah, no, that's a shitload. But I wonder what made him take a break, you know?
Who knows? It might have been work. We'll get into it later. The police contacted a psychologist to analyze their killer, and he was spot on with Chikatilo. But it was he mentioned that he had to have been on a schedule
mm-hmm.
for work, because it was very strict when all of these murders happened and where they happened. So it might have just been work. It might have been family life. It might have been his bloodlust was sated for that amount of time. But yeah, he didn't kill again until June. Okay. By September, though, he had killed another 5 victims. From June to September, there were 6 victims in all, mm-hmm. which is a lot.
That is really a lot of people very quickly.
The accumulation of bodies found and the similarities between the patterns of wounds inflicted on the victims forced Soviet authorities to acknowledge pretty much publicly that a serial killer was on the loose. So they had their inklings. This specialist team of 10 investigators and this analyst knew that they had a serial killer, but it wasn't until these other victims showed up that, like, everyone was like, all right, we've got a serial killer.
Yeah.
On the 6th of September, 1983, the public prosecutor of the USSR formally linked 6 of the murders thus far attributed to the same killer.
Hmm. Okay.
Due to the sheer savagery of the murders and the precision of the evisceration upon the victims' bodies, police theorized that the killings had been conducted by either a group harvesting organs to sell for transplant, the work of a satanic cult, or a mentally ill individual. So,
one of those is right.
There's a lot of details surrounding what these poor victims had to go through before he finally killed them. But basically, he would assault them and then stab them and then cut them open and, like, play with their organs.
Oh, no. Well, mm-hmm. he had to be called the vampire of that for some yeah. reason.
Yep. Mm-hmm. There was even one body who it looked as though he had bitten the nipple off.
Why? Why?
I don't know.
Why is that a common... What? I'm sorry. I wish someone could see my face other than Sam right now. Because I just don't understand why nipples need to come off of bodies. I guess that's why I'm not a serial killer. I hope that's never a connection I make, but, like, what? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. Beginning in September of 1983, several young men confessed to the murders. Although these individuals were often intellectually disabled youths who admitted to the crimes only under prolonged and often brutal interrogation.
Can't do that. You can. It's the USSR. I assume there's not a rule against that. But it's bad police work, and it's not mm-hmm. reliable, and you don't get good confessions that way.
Yeah. 3 known homosexuals and a convicted sex offender committed suicide as a result of investigators' heavy-handed tactics.
Mm.
Now, there is, I guess you could look at it as, like, a silver lining of sorts. As a result of this investigation, more than 1,000 unrelated crimes, including 95 murders, 140 aggravated assaults, and 245 rapes were solved. All looking for Chikatilo.
Okay. There's some... There's a little silver lining. There's something
come out
of that.
There's a little bit of a silver lining. Now back to the horrors that is this murderer.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. However, as police obtained confessions from suspects, bodies continued to be discovered, proving that the suspects who had confessed could not be the killers that the police were seeking for this specific investigation. On the 30th of October, 1983, this is all in 1983, which
is... a duck. Okay.
I know. The eviscerated body of a 19-year-old prostitute named Vera Shevkin was found in Shakhty. So she had been killed on the 27th, but the police weren't sure whether to link her to the other murders, because although the mutilations inflicted upon her were otherwise characteristics of those found upon other victims linked to the unknown murderer, her eyes hadn't been touched. So the police were like, is she one of the victims of this serial killer, or is she not?
Mm-hmm.
2 months later, 14-year-old Sergei Markov was murdered. He suffered over 70 knife wounds before being disemboweled.
Jesus. Okay. Oh, poor baby.
I know. In January and February of 1984, Chikatilo killed 2 women in Rostov's Aviators Park. In March, he killed 10-year-old Dmitry Pachinks. Oh, Jesus. Parashnikov. Parashnikov.
That sounds right.
It's so hard. Okay. So in March, he killed 10-year-old Dmitry Parashnikov. Chikatilo had been seen by several witnesses with the boy, each of which were able to give investigators a detailed description of the killer. Still took years before they found him.
I just want to... Okay.
Oh, get this. When Dmitry's body was found, police also found a footprint on the killer.
Hmm.
Or footprint of the killer. So they had a footprint. At this point, they had blood, and they had several
witness
descriptions.
Why do you not at least go be like, maybe we should ask?
The police were chewed out later for how poorly they handled all of this.
I hope so. I want to know what happened to the police. I really do.
That's part of this story, too.
Oh, good.
On the 25th of May, Chikatilo killed a young woman named Tatiana Petrosyan and her 10-year-old daughter, Svetlana, in a wooded area outside Shakhty. Petrosyan had known Chikatilo for several years prior to her murder. By the end of July, he had killed an additional 3 young women.
This is just, like, I knew that these bodies had to stack up really fast to get to 56 that quickly. Mm-hmm. But just sitting here and hearing it is a different experience.
That's what I was saying. Like, when I was researching this, I was like, oh my God. It's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the summer of 1984, we're in 1984 now. All of that was 1983. This is 1984. Then in the summer of 1984, Chikatilo was fired from his work as a supply clerk for theft of property. So he lost that job, which allowed him to travel around a lot. The accusations of this theft had been filed against him by the previous February, and he had been asked to resign quietly, but he had refused to do so and denied the charges. So again, he was given the option to resign instead of charges being filed, mm-hmm. but he denied that option, so they did file charges.
Okay.
He found another job as a supply clerk in Rostov on August 1st. And to celebrate this new job, he murdered yet another person. 16-year-old Natalia Golosovska.
Why would you just go out to a nice dinner? Why would you celebrate human being?
Just go out to it with your family. Go out to a nice dinner with your family. Celebrate this job. Oh my God. Okay. So then on the 7th, he murdered Lyudmila Alexeyevna. Then by the 15th, he killed an unidentified woman and a young girl. Within 2 weeks, the body of Alexander Chappell was found on the banks of the Don River, just yards from where the first girl, Yelena's, body had been found.
Mm-hmm.
On September 6th, Chikatilo killed librarian Irina Lechinskaya. On the 13th of September 1984, Chikatilo was observed by 2 undercover detectives attempting to talk to young women at the Rostov bus station. The detectives followed him as he wandered through the city trying to approach women in a sexual way in public places. So he wasn't exposing himself. He would go up and try and talk to them and then like rub himself against them.
That's disgusting and creepy.
Yeah, exactly. So detectives... Detectives caught him doing this. He was arrested at this point. Upon Chikatilo's arrival to the city's central market, he was arrested and held. A search of his very belongings revealed a knife with an 8-inch blade, several lengths of rope, and a jar of Vaseline. He was also discovered to be under investigation for minor theft at one of his former employers, which gave the investigators the legal right to hold him for a prolonged period of time. Chikatilo's dubious background was uncovered, and his physical description matched the description of the man seen walking alongside Dmitry prior to the boy's murder. And you would think, oh, yay, he's finally going to be arrested and we're moving into the trial.
No, I wouldn't.
And you would think, wrong.
No, I wouldn't. This is 1984. We've got 6 years left. Okay.
Yep. His name was added to a card index file of potential murderers used by investigators, and then he was released.
That's not good enough.
That's it. That's all. That's all that happened.
Oh my Jesus. Okay.
No, I know. Chikatilo was found guilty of theft of property from his previous employer and sentenced to 1 year in prison, but was freed on the 12th of December, 1984, after serving 3 months.
No.
It's all bad. It's all bad. On October 8th, 1984, the head of the Russian Public Prosecutor's Office formally linked 23 of Chikatilo's murders into one case and dropped all charges against the mentally handicapped youths who had previously confessed to the murders. So it wasn't until 1984 that they stopped looking at these poor boys who they had coerced into a confession.
At least they did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they that's did. Really bad. It should not have taken that long. That is completely inexcusable. But, like, good for them. Maybe they can go back to their lives.
Yeah, maybe the police can actually focus on actual police work. So, upon his release from prison in December of 1984, Chikatilo found new work as a locomotive factor in a locomotive factory at Novocherkassk and kept a low profile. He did not kill again until August 1st of 1985. When, on a business trip to Moscow, he encountered an 18-year-old woman named Natalie Poklostova at a railway platform near Domodedovo Airport. He stabbed her 38 times and then strangled her to death.
Oh, good Lord.
Mm-hmm.
She died of asphyxia?
Yeah, he stabbed her 38 times. She was still alive, and he got frustrated, so he strangled her to death. Poor girl. Based upon the hypothesis that the killer had traveled from the Rostov Oblast to Moscow via air, investigators checked all Aeroflight records of passengers who had commuted between Moscow and Rostov Oblast between late July and early August. On this occasion, however, Chikatilo had traveled to Moscow by train, and accordingly, no documentation existed for investigators to research. So they had started catching on that he moved around a lot. So they started checking air travel. But for this murder, he had traveled by train. So there was just no record of him.
Okay.
4 weeks later, on the 27th of August, Chikatilo killed another woman, Irina Gulyava, in Shakhty. As had been the case with his previous murders, the wound inflicted upon this particular victim linked her murder to the hunt for the serial killer. So, just like all his previous victims, she bore the same wounds, so they added her to the list of women that they had compiled for this one murderer. But, like I said, because he traveled by train, they didn't know who it was.
Okay.
In November of 1985, a special prosecutor, Issa Kostiev, was appointed to supervise the investigation. So they got another special prosecutor, which had, by this stage, expanded to include 15 procurators and 29 detectives assigned to work exclusively on this one manhunt. They had 29 people, 15 procurators, 2 prosecutors, still nothing.
What is a procurator?
I don't know.
I'm sorry. This is off topic.
No, it's fine.
But I just...
An agent representing others in courts of law in countries retaining Roman civil law. So, like a prosecutor. Basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That many people working on one case. You have so many resources devoted to this.
Yep. It's ridiculous. And it's not like he was trying to be under the... It's not like he was the Zodiac and just disappeared in the dead of night. So many people saw this man.
Yeah, so he's not really being sneaky. He's got a lot of witnesses, and he's just... He's not smooth, and he's not... charming, and he doesn't have, like, the Ted Bundy era, like,
no thing. Like, because Ted Bundy was added to a list. That's how they eventually got him, was so many people had called in, and when he murdered those two girls at the lake, so many people had called in and been like, hey, that looks like Ted Bundy, but it couldn't be Ted Bundy. So they added him to a list, too. But then his girlfriend called in and was like, So I think my boyfriend is the murderer. And they were like, all right, let's look into this. But with this man, like, they had this description. So many people was like, this is what he looks like. No one even suspected Chikatilo. They had his name and then just let him go.
What is his wife doing during this?
Taking care of the children? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what's happening during 1984 in Russia.
Okay, fair.
Fair. I don't know where women's rights movements were at the time. Could she work? I don't know. So, the known murders linked to the manhunt were carefully reinvestigated, and police began another round of questioning of known sex offenders and homosexuals. So they circled back around to that wrong thing. The sex offenders was right, but the homosexuals was wrong. The following month, the basically military resumed the patrolling of railway stations around Rostov, and plainclothed female officers were ordered to loiter around bus and train stations. At the request of Viktor Burakov, remember that special detective that's had all this time and hasn't found shit, police also took the step of consulting a psychiatrist. This was probably the best step they took. Dr. Alexander Bukhanovsky.
Okay.
And this is some proper Mindhunter shit. This is proper, like, BAU CSI stuff.
Good, because, like, that or science FBI. Had been around for a while at this point. And, I mean, I'm sure it's the Soviet Union. I don't really know how advanced they were or how...
I don't know
anything about the Soviet Union other than, like, my whole family is afraid of Russia. That's it.
Yeah.
Because they grew up during the Cold War. But, like... That's just, they are sophisticated as far as I know. Like, they're scientifically advancing and they're trying to do things with fewer resources, admittedly, than the US. But, like, you've got shit in space. There's no reason they can't figure out psychology.
Right. Oh my gosh. Okay. So, this was the first such consultation in a serial killer investigation in the Soviet Union. So it basically got so bad that they were like, we don't know what to do. Let's go to a psychologist.
Okay.
All crime scene and medical examiner's reports were made available to Dr. Alexander upon the understanding he would produce a psychological profile of the unknown murderer for the investigation. So they went to him with everything they had and was like, please, dear God, help us.
Good. Mm-hmm.
He produced a 65-page psychological profile describing the killer. And described him as a reclusive man aged between 45 and 50 years old who had endured a painful and isolated childhood, who was incapable of flirting or courtship with women. This individual was of average intelligence, likely to be married and have fathered children, but also a sadist who suffered from impotence and could achieve sexual arousal only by seeing his victims suffer. The murders themselves were an analog to the sexual intercourse this individual is incapable of performing. So right on the fucking head.
I was going to say, like, that is absolutely, you were correct, exactly, sir. Good job.
Exactly. Point by point correct. Which is why psychological profiling is super important.
Yes.
Because many of the killings had occurred on weekdays near mass transport hubs and across the entire Rostov Oblast, Dr. Alexander also argued that the killer's work required him to travel regularly. And based upon the actual days of the week when the killings had occurred, the killer was most likely tied to a production schedule. So, I mean, he was right on the money.
Oh, yeah.
He hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, absolutely. He's correct. Mm-hmm.
Chikatilo followed the investigation carefully. So, because at this point, they had been broadcasting it at this point. And he followed the investigation, reading newspaper reports about the manhunt for the killer, which had begun to appear in the news media, and keeping his homicidal urges under control. It's at this point where he started tapering back because he's like, oh, shit, they're on to me. Mm-hmm. For almost a year following the August 1985 murder of the librarian Arina, no further victims were found in either the Rostov or Moscow oblasts whose bodies bore the signature mutilations of the unknown murderer. investigators did tentatively link the murder of a 33-year-old woman named Lyubov Golovakia. And she was found stabbed to death near Rostov. There's a name, but I can't. It's M-Y-A-S-N-I-K-O-V-S-K-Y.
Nope.
Exactly. Maya Snikovsky. Okay. Stabbed to death in the Maya Snikovsky, God damn it, district of Rostov on July 23rd, 1986. So they added her to the investigation as a potential victim of this one killer.
Okay.
On the 18th of August, 1986, a victim was found buried in a depression of earth in the grounds of a collective farm in the city of Batyask, I think. The wounds inflicted on this victim bore the trademark mutilations of the victims linked to the manhunt killed between 1982 and 1985. The victim was an 18-year-old secretary named Irina Pogorilova. And this was really the first victim that he tried to hide. The rest he just sort of left where they were. This one was the first one that they found in somewhat of a grave.
Okay.
By the autumn of 1986, investigators in Rostov theorized that the unknown killer may have moved to another part of the Soviet Union and continued killing there. As the three victims killed in the rest of Oblast in 1985 and 1986 had died in August, some investigators gave credence to the possibility the perpetrator may have relocated to another part of the Soviet Union and may only be returning to the Rostov Oblast in summer. I'm sure I'm saying Rostov wrong. The Rostov police compiled the police compiled bulletins to be sent to all forces throughout the Soviet Union, describing the pattern of wounds their unknown killer inflicted upon his victims and requesting feedback from any police force who had discovered murder victims with wounds matching those upon the victims found in the Rostov Oblast. The response was negative.
Okay.
So it wasn't until 1986 that they shared with police and other places in the Soviet Union, like, details of this murder.
Y'all. Okay.
It's all bad. It's all bad. Okay.
It's bad. It's bad.
In 1987, Chikatilo killed three times. Each murder took place while he was on a business trip far away from Rostov, and none of these murders were linked to the manhunt in Rostov.
Okay.
It's R-O-S-T-O-V. I think it's Rostov. 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 If any of you speak Russian, good on ya, because this is hard. Mm-hmm. In 1988, Chikatilo killed three more times. An unidentified woman in Krasny, Sulon, in April, and two boys in May and July. He didn't kill again until March 1st, 1989. So the body count has decreased due to this increased police investigation. So in 1987, he killed three people. In 1988, he killed three people. And then he didn't kill again until March 1st, 1989.
He slowed down significantly.
Mm-hmm. In 1989, he killed a 16-year-old girl in his daughter's vacant apartment.
Oh no.
He dismembered her body and hid the remains in a sewer. As the victim had been dismembered, police did not link her murder to the investigation.
You've got a guy who's on your potential murderer list, and a body ends up in his kid's apartment, and you don't ask him about that? You don't... I... Y'all...
Okay.
Okay.
With the resurfacing of victims definitively linked to the manhunt and the fact that the majority of these victims' bodies have been discovered close to railway stations, investigators assigned numerous plainclothes officers to discreetly film and photograph passengers on trains throughout the Rostov Oblast. Several trains were also fitted with hidden cameras with the intention of filming or photographing a victim in the company of his or her murderer. So Okay. Now they're focusing on train stations instead of the airport.
Good.
On March 11th, or on the 11th of March, the leaders of the investigation, headed by Mikhail Fetisov, same guy from the beginning, held a meeting to discuss the progress made in the manhunt. What progress?
What progress? You figured out it's the same dude. Congratulations.
Congrats.
You found a body that was dismembered in his daughter's apartment.
Well, they found it in the sewer close to his daughter's apartment. I know, it's not much.
Okay.
So Fetisov was under intense pressure from the public, the press, and the Ministry of the Interior in Moscow.
I can't imagine why. No clue. I don't know why he wasn't, like, asked to do something else. Like, it's okay, Mikhail. Like, just go sit in the corner for a while. Here's a stack of papers. They're not important, but you can organize them by color. They're all white. Go for it. Knock yourself out. We're going to give this to this other dude.
Oh my gosh. Right? Okay.
It just doesn't... I don't feel like you need a really sophisticated police force or legal system to go, huh, we've got a guy's name on the list. I assume it's a pretty big list. I do. It's not just like, oh, here's a list with three names. It's fine. No, like, I assume there's a lot of people on this. But you have, like, a list, and you don't check in with these people, or you don't keep tabs on them for some, or you don't, like, if someone gets murdered in their vicinity, you don't go, like, say hello.
They spent years looking at homosexuals and intellectually disabled men. Years.
It's not a good time. It's still really genuinely a bad time to be intellectually disabled or gay in Russia. That hasn't improved drastically. But, like, you've interviewed the gay people. You got a couple disabled people to confess. You have at this point decided it's not them.
Bodies are still piling up, and they're still... Well, bodies were piling up, and they were still going after those same people. Like, it's obviously not them. They're in your custody.
Seriously. Like, maybe...
His name on a list of...
Maybe just look around and be like, even if it is them, maybe we should ask around a little more than we're doing.
You have his name on a list with his criminal background. You have all these people. You have people, the very first murder, who were just like, hey, it's this one guy. And y'all went, nah, it's this other guy whose blood matched his wife.
And it's not, that's the thing. It's not like he hasn't been a suspect in at least some of these. You're not going to follow back up with him?
None. They took him in, took his name down, let him go. And that was like the end of their investigation on him.
Yeah, it's not like you put dude's name on the murder list because he was associated with something completely different.
Different, exactly.
It was with this thing. It was
You found him in the very train stations that you are now strictly watching, doing real questionable shit. And you were just like, take his name down, let him go.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all bad. Okay.
It's super easy for us to sit here and criticize. And I don't know how hard police work actually is because I don't do it, because that was not a thing that I decided to do with my criminology degree.
But I feel like even not knowing all that information, how all that works, I feel like this is still like a huge miscarry of justice.
It is a miscarriage of justice. It's just, it's,
you executed a man for a murder he didn't commit.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. The intensity of the manhunt in the years up to 1984 had receded to a degree between 1985 and 1987. So they even backed off. But that's because he wasn't killing as much.
Yeah.
When Chikatilo had committed only three murders, investigators had conclusively linked to the killer, all killed in 1986. However, by March 1990, a further six victims had been linked to the killer. In addition, following the introduction of greater media freedom as a result of Glasnost, The Soviet news media was much less repressed than it had been in the early years of the manhunt, and as such devoted extensive publicity to the case. Fedosov had also noted laxity in some areas of the investigation and warned that people would be fired if the killer was not caught soon. So it's only in 1990 that they're doubling down on this investigation.
God, okay.
And then Chikatilo killed three further people by August 1990. It's almost like he's laughing in the face of the police at this point.
It really is. And like that specifically, this is a perfect example of why you need a free and independent press and why that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
However, what is happening?
Continue. We're getting close to him getting discovered. The discovery of more victims sparked a massive police operation. Because several victims' bodies had been discovered at a railway station on one rail route through the Rostov Oblast, Viktor Burakov suggested a plan to saturate all large stations in the Rostov Oblast, with an obvious uniformed police presence, which the killer could not fail to notice. So now, instead of hidden or plainclothes officers, they're just like, just flood him with officers. Maybe we'll deter him.
Mm-hmm.
The intention was to discourage the killer from attempting to strike at any of these locations and to have undercover agents patrol smaller and less busy stations where the murderer's activities would be more likely to be noticed. The plan was approved, and both the uniformed and undercover officers were instructed to question any adult man in the company of a young woman or child and note his name and passport number. Police deployed 360 men at all the stations in the Rostov Oblast, but only undercover officers were posted at the three smallest stations on the route through the Oblast where the killer had struck most frequently. The operation was implemented on the 27th of October, 1990. Then on October 30th, the police found the body of 16-year-old boy named Vadim Gromov and at the Dolinskoz station. And that was one of the three smaller stations that they had put plainclothes officers at. So it did. He stopped going to the bigger stations, but they still didn't catch him.
Why would you? Okay. I feel like I'm just grabbing more things. I'm just pulling at straws at this point. If you have officers that are stationed at stations where you know that he has killed people before, why do you not have more people where you know that he's comfortable enough to kill people? What? No. Why? What? Why?
Their whole plan was flood these big train stations with a lot of
that just sounds like a publicity stunt. That doesn't even sound like police work.
Well, it's sort of they had no idea like where he was going to strike, where they should be looking out. So I get the idea to narrow the funnel into these three stations
and then you don't man those stations adequately.
They didn't man them adequately. They put plainclothes officers there, but it didn't help. So on the same day that Gromov's body was found, Chikatilo killed 16-year-old Viktor Tishchenko. His body bore 40 separate knife wounds, and he was found on November 3rd. On the 6th of November, 1990, Chikatilo killed and mutilated a 22-year-old woman named Svetlana Korostik in the woodland area near that smaller station where Gromov's body was found. Returning to the railway platform, he was observed by an undercover officer named Igor Yabakov.
Sure.
So in the end, their plan worked, and this is really sort of how he was caught. But not before he was like, ha ha ha, fuck you, look at me. So Igor observed Chikatilo's approach a well and wash his hands and face. And he had just gotten done killing this 22-year-old girl. So he went to a well, washed his hands and face. And Igor was like, that's a little weird. So Chikatilo approached the station. And Igor noted that Chikatilo's coat had grass and soil stains on the elbows. Chikatilo also had a small red smear on his cheek and what appeared to be a severe wound on one of his fingers. To Igor, it looked suspicious. The only reason people entered the woodland near that station at that time of the year was to gather wild mushrooms, which was a popular pastime in Russia. But Chikatilo was not dressed like a typical forest scavenger, and he was wearing formal attire, and he had a nylon sports bag, which was unsuitable for carrying mushrooms.
Okay.
So, Igor stopped Chikatilo and checked his papers, but had no formal reason to arrest him. So he let him go.
Okay.
When Igor returned to his office, he filed a routine report containing the name of the person he had stopped at the station and the possible blood smear observed on his cheek. So on the 13th of November, Korostik's body was found, making her the 36th known victim linked to the manhunt. And that was the girl he had murdered where he was stopped because he had grass stains and wasn't appropriately dressed and had blood on him.
Okay.
So police summoned the officer in charge of surveillance. They summoned Igor and examined the reports of all men stopped in question in the previous week. Not only was Chikatilo's name among these reports, but it was familiar to several officers involved in the case because he had been questioned in 1984 and had been placed upon a 1987 suspect list compiled and distributed throughout the Soviet Union. So all of these officers were like, oh yeah, that guy, we've stopped him before. Julia is just like, her hands are covering her face and she's screaming into them right now. I think it's important for everyone to know that.
She's having a
small breakdown.
Three times. It's not just once. It's not just you put his name on a murder list one time. You caught him so many times.
Also, it's noted that, like, it should be noted that each time they've caught him, they have, I didn't put this in the marks, but each time in the notes, but each time they have caught him, they've noticed how much he looks like the police, like the witness description of the murderer. All right.
I just.
Okay. So. After checking with Chikatilo's present and previous employers, investigators were able to place him in various towns and cities at times when several victims linked to the investigation had been murdered. Questioning the former colleagues from Chikatilo's teaching days revealed that he had been forced to resign from two teaching positions due to repeated complaints of lewd behavior and sexual assault made by his pupils. So the police didn't even know about that because nobody reported it.
I hate people. Okay, I know.
Okay. Police placed Chikatilo under surveillance on the 14th of November. Finally. In several instances, particularly on trains or buses, he was observed approaching lone young women or children and engaging them in conversation. If the woman or child broke off from the conversation, Chikatilo would wait a few minutes and then seek another conversation partner. On the 20th of November, after 6 days of surveillance, Chikatilo was arrested by four plainclothes officers. Upon his arrest, Chikatilo gave a statement claiming that the police were mistaken and complained that he had also been arrested in 1984 for the same series of murders. Maybe don't bring up that previous arrest. That's a lawyer in me. Just don't say anything.
Maybe don't.
Okay. A strip search of Chikatilo revealed a further piece of evidence. One of Chikatilo's fingers had a flesh wound. So remember when when Igor had noted that it looked like he had been bitten? Medical examiners concluded the wound was from a human bite. Chikatilo's penultimate victim, Viktor Tishchenko, was a physically strong youth. At the crime scene, police had found numerous signs of a ferocious physical struggle between the victim and his murderer, and a finger bone. He bit off part of Chikatilo's finger. But Chikatilo never sought medical treatment for his injuries because he knew he couldn't get to the hospital.
Well, yeah. Why would you? That's going to raise some questions. Gee, mm-hmm. How'd you lose your finger? Yep. Oh.
No, bitch. It just
bar
fell
fight.
Off. Bar fight.
Sometimes they just, I don't know.
So, on the 21st of November, the formal questioning of Chikatilo began. On the 29th of November, because Russia, I do know this part because it was in Wikipedia. So you're able to hold a suspect much longer in Russia than you are in the United States. I think it was like 10 days, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And then you have to let them go if you don't have evidence.
Okay.
So on November 29th, at the request of Burakov and Fedosov, Dr. Alexander was invited to assist in the questioning of the suspect. Because up until then, Chikatilo was like, no, you're wrong. He would just shut down complete questionings. He'd get angry and argue back with them and just scream at them, no, you're wrong. So he got particularly mad because they went about this thinking that he was severely mentally ill, which he was, but he didn't like being treated like that. So he fought back.
Okay.
So Dr. Alexander was invited to assist in the questioning of the suspect. And Alexander read extracts from his 65-page psychological profile to Chikatilo. Within 2 hours, Chikatilo burst into tears and confessed to Alexander that he was indeed guilty of the crimes for which he had been arrested.
Good job, dude.
It was super effective.
Good job.
Which he would know because psychology.
Right.
They should have just gone to him to begin with. They should have been like, look, we think we have the guy. Can you help us? So after conversing into the evening, so this took a while longer because he had to tell them about all the fucking murders. So after conversing into the evening, Dr. Alexander reported to Burakov and Fedosov that Chikatilo was ready to confess. Chikatilo gave a full, detailed description of each murder on the list of charges, all of which were consistent with known facts regarding each killing. When prompted, he could draw a rough sketch of various crime scenes, indicating the position of the victim's bodies and various landmarks in the vicinity of the crime scenes.
That's a pretty good indication that that's the right guy.
When questioned as to why most of his later victims' eyes had been stabbed and or slashed, but not completely removed as his earlier victims' eyes had been, Chikatilo stated that he had initially believed an old Russian superstition that the image of a murderer is left imprinted upon the eyes of its victim. Of the victim.
Okay.
However, he stated in later years, he had become convinced that this was simply an old wives' tale and he had ceased to gouge out the eyes of the victims because they never caught on to him.
Wow.
He was just like, well, apparently it's not true because they haven't found me.
He's doing investigative work that's on par with the police force at this point.
So Chikatilo also informed Kostyov, he had often tasted the blood of his victims, and this is where the vampire part comes in. On the 30th of November, Chikatilo was formally charged with each of the 34 murders he confessed to, all of which had been committed between June 1982 and November 1990. But Sam, you might be saying, they got him on 56 murders. You are right. So over the following days, Chikatilo confessed to a further 22 killings, which had not been connected to the case. So they charged him on the 34 that they had connected to the case. And over the following days, he was like, by the way, there's 22 more.
Oh, my God. Okay. Oh, boy.
So right. It's when he confessed to those murders that they realized that Yelena, his first victim, where they went after that one guy who was just not associated with it in any way, that's when they realized he was innocent.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm.
So, on August 20th, 1991, after police had completed their interrogation, including reenactments of all the murders at each crime scene, which must have been horrifying to see.
My God.
Oh, That, at this point, I do not envy the police. Like, no.
But you know what? At this point, maybe the police can sit through that because they've been sitting on this dude since 1984, at least.
Chikatilo was transferred to the Serbsky Institute in Moscow to undergo a 60-day psychiatric evaluation to determine whether he was mentally competent to stand trial.
I wonder why.
Right. Chikatilo was analyzed by a senior psychiatrist, Dr. Andrei Tkachenko. Tkachenko did note that Chikatilo suffered from various physiological problems, which he attributed to prenatal brain damage.
That's not great.
Mm-hmm. But concluded on the 18th of October that although suffering from borderline personality disorder with sadistic features, he was fit to stand trial.
Good.
So now we're going to trial.
Good. Oh, my favorite.
This is my favorite part because the judge hated this man and did not bother to hide it.
Oh, good.
So Andrei Tkachenko was brought to trial in Rostov and on the 14th of April, 1992, he was charged with 53 counts of murder in addition to 5 charges of sexual assault against minors committed when he had been a teacher. So they charged him with a murder and then was like, you know what? Fuck you. We're going to charge you with the sexual assaults, too.
Good. Mm-hmm. Hit him with everything. Hit him with
exactly
literally every single thing that you can at this point.
Exactly. So the first 2 days of the trial were devoted to Judge Akub Sonov. It's a Akubzhanov.
I am so sorry. I have no idea. I have not one clue.
Y'all missed it because I'm going to cut it. But we had a very long discussion about how to say this name. We're devoted to Judge Akubzhanov. Reading the long list of indictments against Chikatilo. So the first two days of the trial were just him reading the long list of indictments against Chikatilo.
Good. Maybe don't commit enough crimes, then it takes 2 days to read them. Maybe that's a good starting point.
Each murder was discussed individually, and on several occasions, relatives present in the courtroom broke down in tears or fainted when details of their relatives' murders were revealed. After reading the indictment, Judge Akubzhanov announced to the journalists present in the courtroom his intention to conduct an open trial, stating, quote, let this trial at least teach us something so that this will never happen anytime or anywhere again.
Good.
Judge Akubzhanov then asked Chikatilo to stand, identify himself, and provide his date and location of birth. Chikatilo complied, although this would prove to be one of the few civil exchanges between the judge and Chikatilo. Like, he asked him to stand, provide his date and location of birth, and then from there on out, he was just like, I fucking hate you.
Good.
Yeah.
Not good, because your judge is supposed to be impartial. But this isn't America.
It really didn't change anything, to be honest. No,
you're going to jail. A trial at this point is completely a formality.
Exactly. In what became a regular, though not continuous, occurrence throughout the trial, Judge Akubzhanov berated Chikatilo as he questioned him in detail as to the charges, ordering him to, quote, shut your mouth before adding, quote, you're not crazy. As Chikatilo's response to the questions deviated into his discussing issues such as the repression his family had endured throughout his childhood and his claiming that the charges filed against him were false. Basically, any time Chikatilo or his defense attorney tried to bring up a defense, the judge was like, shut your fucking mouth. There is no defense.
You're not mitigating this. Quit it.
No. The verbal exchanges would occur whether Chikatilo was cooperative or uncooperative throughout the proceedings, and the manner in which the judge questioned Chikatilo repeatedly led Chikatilo's defense lawyer, Murat Kabublin. Kabibublin. Why, Russia?
No, I'm so sorry for laughing. No, I'm watching your face as you're trying to read this, and you have no control over your facial expressions.
None.
You look so confused, and that's what I'm laughing at.
There are just letters that don't need to go together to make a word. All right.
Okay.
His defense lawyer, this repeatedly led to Ciccatillo's defense lawyer protesting against the accusatory nature of the court proceedings. No, duh. In the instances in which Ciccatillo was uncooperative throughout the questioning, he would simply shout over the judge, denounce the court as a farce, and launch into rambling, disjointed speeches. On occasion, Ciccatillo would also expose himself to the court or sing socialist movement anthems throughout the proceedings. These antics regularly resulted in his being returned to his cell as court proceedings continued in his absence. The judge did not give two shits about
about
a fair trial. He was just like, we're going to put you in jail forever. I don't care what you have to say.
Listen, at this point, you're going to jail. I know that it's a form, but all that I can honestly think of is just this guy being like the American equivalent would be this guy just like pantsing everybody and singing God Bless America as he's drug out of the back of the courtroom by his shirt.
And pantsing everybody else. This guy just like exposing himself and then singing God Bless America as he's dragged out of the court. That's what the equivalent of this is.
That's exactly.
And the judge just screaming after him, fuck you! That's what's happened in this court.
Oh, man.
Okay.
We all think that Judge Judy is fun.
If it weren't, like, because they do have to get into the horrifying details of his murders. If it weren't for that, this would be a fun trial to watch.
Seriously, yeah.
Okay. On the 21st of April, Ciccatillo's defense lawyer requested that Dr. Alexander be allowed to testify as to the contents of the 1985 psychological profile he had written and his subsequent consultation with Ciccatillo following his arrest, adding that Alexander could exert influence over Ciccatillo and, by extension, might influence the court proceedings. I don't know why he thought that would be a reasonable request. This request was denied. The same day, Ciccatillo began to refuse to answer any questions from the judge, the prosecutor, or his own defense lawyer.
Oh, that's not a great strategy.
No. He refused to answer any questions for 3 consecutive days.
Okay.
Before stating his presumption of innocence had been irredeemably violated by the judge and that he intended to give no further testimony, the following day, proceedings were adjourned for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Ciccatillo withdrew his confessions to 6 of the killings for which he had been charged on the 13th of May, and also claimed that he had killed 4 further victims who were not included upon the indictments. So he withdrew his confessions for 6 of them and went, oh, by the way, there's 4 more.
Okay, sure. You go for it.
Just, you're gonna be put to death.
It's important to have this accurately reflected. It really is.
So, let's see. The same day, his defense lawyer again submitted a request that his client be subjected to a second psychiatric evaluation. The motion was dismissed by the judge as being groundless. In response, his defense attorney rose from his seat, condemning the composition of the court and arguing that the judge was unfit to continue presiding over the case, which in all honesty, he definitely was.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's you're right, but you're losing.
Yeah. Ciccatillo himself repeated his earlier remarks as to the judge making numerous rash remarks, prejudging his guilt. So Ciccatillo himself was just like, yeah, he decided I was guilty before this whole trial began. And in response, almost everybody in the room was just like, we decided you were guilty before this whole trial began.
Wait, I don't know if you know why you're here. We know why you're here, dude. It's just...
Here's the thing. The prosecutor vocally supported the defense's claim, stating that the judge had indeed made too many such comments and had committed numerous procedural violations in his lecturing and insulting the defendant. So the prosecutor further contended that in his conducting an open trial, Chikatilo had already been effectively prejudged as being guilty by the press, before also requesting that the judge be replaced. So it got so bad that the prosecutor was like, I think we need a new judge. It was a shit show of a court
really
meeting.
Bad.
On the 3rd of July, Dr. Alexander was permitted to testify as to his analysis of Chikatilo, although solely in the capacity as a witness. For 3 hours, Dr. Alexander testified as to his 1985 psychological profile of Chikatilo and of the conversation he had with Chikatilo following his arrest. Four psychiatric experts from the Serbsky Institute also testified as to the result of a behavioral analysis they had conducted on Chikatilo in May. Following the initial adjournment of the trial. So all of these psychologists testified as to his behavior in the courtroom being strikingly at contrast to his behavior in his cell, and that they considered his antics to be a calculated attempt to obtain acquittal on the grounds of insanity. So it completely backfired in his defense attorney's face, because all of them were like, nah, he's not like this outside of the courtroom. We think he's just trying to get an acquittal.
Oh, no.
So the court announced a recess, and the brother of Lyudmila Alexeeva, the 17-year-old girl killed by Chikatilo in August of 1984, threw a heavy chunk of metal at Chikatilo, hitting him in the chest. When security tried to arrest the young man, the other victim's relatives shielded him.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not, like, ideologically, I totally understand where they're coming from.
All kinds of
good
shit.
On you, but also, I'm conflicted about that. Not helping
what is already a shit show of a court. So on the 14th of August, on the 14th of October, the court reconvened to hear formal sentencing. The sentencing would not finish until the following day. The judge, he still hadn't been dismissed. Judge Akupchinov began sentencing by announcing Chikatilo guilty of 52 of the 53 murders for which he had been tried. He was sentenced to death for each offense.
What?
Chikatilo.
What was the one that he, like, didn't?
Maybe he was like, maybe I should tone it down. I'll get him for 52 of them. Maybe I shouldn't tell him to shut his fucking mouth anymore. Oh my gosh. Okay. So Chikatilo was also found guilty of five counts of sexual assault committed during the years he worked as a teacher. So he was found guilty of those assaults. In reciting his findings, the judge read the list of murders again before criticizing both the police and the prosecutor's department for various mistakes in the investigation, which had allowed Chikatilo to remain free until 1990. So it just was bad police work.
It was. There's no way that bad police work wasn't involved in this.
Yes.
I don't believe it.
Particular criticism was directed towards not the local police, but the prosecutor's department, primarily the prosecutor Isa Kostyev, whom Judge Akupchinov scathed as negligent. And who had been dismissive of Chikatilo's inclusion upon a 1987 suspect list compiled by the police. So his name was put on that 1987 suspect list, but the prosecutor was like, I don't think it's him. So the judge also rejected the numerous claims that the prosecutor, Isa, had made to the media in the months prior to the trial that police had deliberately withheld documents pertaining to Chikatilo from the prosecutor's department as being provably baseless, adding that proof existed he had been in possession of all internal bulletins. So in response to the judge going, you're really bad at your job, the prosecutor Isa was just like, listen, I didn't get these documents. And the judge was like, you're fucking lying. I've really like this judge. He shouldn't be a judge if this is how he acts in the courtroom, but I like him nonetheless.
No, he should. He's a fantastic attorney and should have stayed as an attorney.
On the 15th of October, the judge formally sentenced Ciccatillo to death plus 86 years for the 52 murders and 5 counts of sexual assault which he had been found guilty. Just in case, you know, just in case he pops up from the grave as a vampire, you still got those 86 years.
At least make him not my problem. Not my problem. I'll be dead by the time that he is released.
Ciccatillo kicked his bench across his cage when he heard the verdict. So they eventually had to put him in a cage for the court proceedings. He kicked his bench across it and began shouting abuse. However, when given an opportunity to make a speech in response to the verdict, he again remained silent. Upon passing the final sentence, the judge made the following remark. Quote, taking into consideration the horrible misdeeds of which he is guilty, this court has no alternative but to impose the only sentence that he deserves. I therefore sentence him to death.
Good.
I love this judge.
Okay. Yeah. Good job.
And then on the 14th of February, 1994, Ciccatillo was taken from his death row cell to a soundproof room in a prison. I can't pronounce this. I'm not even going to lie to you. He was taken from his death row cell to a soundproof room within the prison and executed with a single gunshot behind the right ear. Goody. He is buried in an unmarked grave at the prison cemetery.
Good.
And that is the story of Andre Ciccatillo.
That's horrifying. That is absolutely just... And I know that was the sanitized version. I know you cut out a lot of the really awful details.
Yeah.
And I just, God, am I angry.
I know. Like, I would be that judge too. If I was the judge in that case, I would conduct myself the exact same way, which is probably why I should never be a judge. But if you came to me, and like I said, like Julia said, this is the sanitized version. They got the full details. I would be like, shut your fucking mouth. You're not crazy. You're going to die. Just sit down.
Okay. So,
my sources for the first part of the vampire series and this second ending part are Wikipedia, Plague and Vampirism in the Middle Ages by Camillo Di Cicco. Last Podcast on the Left, Lore, Creepy Historical Vampire, The Terrifying Tale of Peter Plogojewitz at theunexplainedmysteries.com. Was This the Castle, the Home of a Real Vampire at the13thfloor.com, The Legend of the Onwick Vampire at hauntedplaceblog.com, The Legend of the Croatian Vampire Jorgrando at slavarun.org. The Wailing Zombie Priest of Melrose Abbey at scotsman.com, which is a lovely title.
Yeah.
Travel Through History at travelthroughhistory.com and The Great New England Vampire Panic at smithsonianmag.com.
That's
plus
fantastic.
A few others, but I lost all of my sources. So these were the ones I could track back down. So yeah. Okay. And that is vampires.
That's
from olden age to almost present day.
Wow. Just wow.
I know. It's a lot. I would 100% rather face off against something that's some undead body that's dragged itself out of the grave.
Yeah, than that dude. Yeah, mm-hmm. Me too. Seriously. Realistically, I stand no chance against either of those. I am feeble and weak and will not survive an encounter with...
Hey, you know, if you remember from the last episode, showing a picture of Jesus to one of these will weaken it enough to stab it in the heart. Look upon our Christ. Ugh. Yeah, no. So, well, that's all that we have for you today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Julia, tell the people where they can find us.
Well, for one thing, if you want us to talk about something else ever, please write into us at whatsinyourhometown@gmail.com with your suggestions or stories or anecdotes. We really love hearing from you. You can also find us on social media. We're at WIYHT on Twitter. We're at What's in Your Hometown on Instagram. And you can also find us wherever you find the Civilized Creatures Entertainment Network. So,
Yep.
Check us out. We're hopefully going to be on Podcast of the Roundtable eventually. I think that'll be really fun.
I want to be on Podcast of the Roundtable so bad. I want to do it with you, though.
Oh, it'll be really fun.
Because I'm horribly shy and socially awkward, and I need you to ground me.
That's fine. If you put the two of us together, you get one socially functional adult.
You get, let's be real, you get 3/4 of a socially functional adult.
You're correct. But yeah, no, check them out. Check us out. Thank you so much for listening to us. We'll try to get back onto a more regular schedule soon. The bar exam is coming back up again, so I'm a little scarce, and that's what's messing with our schedule. But
well, also we've had a string of technical issues that are driving us crazy.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show.
Thanks
for tuning in. And I guess all that leaves us with is with the weird, crazy, how could you not see that shit in the world? You have got to wonder.
What's in your hometown?
Bye.
Bye-bye.